And now let's turn to King David. When last we left this other man of gargantuan appetites, he had defeated Goliath, and we are in chapter 18. He defeated Goliath and was about to make Saul's life difficult. Whether deliberately or not, we will come to. But I'm going to read out of the JPS translation. But again, if you have the altar, that's also good. And if there are differences that strike you as significant, feel free to let us know. Okay. When David finished speaking with Saul, Jonathan's soul became bound up with the soul of David. Jonathan loved David as himself. Now I'm going to just two quick things about this. One is there's been a lot of speculation through the years about whether the relationship between Jonathan and David was homosexual or not. I think most biblical scholars, not all, think not, and I think they're probably right for two reasons. One is that speaking in romantic tones about friendship in the ancient and medieval world was very common. It's not now, but it was then. And so, first of all, the fact that David says after Jonathan dies, his love was for me sweeter than the love of women, doesn't mean that it's a sexual love. In fact, in some ways, quite the opposite. He's saying it's even sweeter than the kind of sexual love that I had with women, although David's record with women was not, was a checkered history at best. But the other reason, and maybe the more compelling reason, that most scholars think that it wasn't a homosexual relationship, and again, I want to emphasize, we don't know, and it could have been. It's not certainly not outside the realm of possibility. But the other reason they think is that homosexuality was frowned upon in the ancient world. So, A, it's unlikely that David would have bragged about it, and B, it's even less likely that it would have been recorded his eulogy, if his eulogy was thought to imply that they had a gay relationship, because obviously in biblical times it was frowned upon, and we hear almost nothing about it. You pay your money and you take your choice. However you choose to regard it, you can regard it. What is more interesting to me, actually, than that, since that we can't know, is that, again, David just happens to become best friends with the person who is heir to the kingship. So you got to figure, maybe he just, spotted Jonathan at the mall and said, I like that guy, he seems like a good guy. But it's an extraordinary coincidence that the person who could most be beneficial to him in the world, the person whose position he wishes to take, that's who he becomes friendly with. And there's a little bit of kind of All About Eve here, if you ever saw that movie. It's where a woman basically befriends an older, although in this case not older, star in the secret hopes of usurping her, which she does. And the older star is Betty Davis, and it's a great movie. So what happens right after? Saul took him into his service that day and wouldn't let him return to his father's house. So he has now become indispensable to the king and best friends with the king's kid. Jonathan and David made a pact because Jonathan loved him as himself. Now notice that it twice says Jonathan loved David as himself. It has yet to say David loved Jonathan as himself, which is kind of interesting. It doesn't say that he didn't, but it doesn't say that he did, and it twice says. And one of the things, just like the story that I said before the class began, one of the things that was clearly true about David is he's charming. He knows how to get his way, and he gets his way here with Saul, with Saul's son, and remember that in a little while, he's going to marry Saul's daughter. So, and it's not, that doesn't make him king. What it does is it quiets a certain section of the populace that would say it's not legitimate for him to be king, because if you're married to the king's daughter and best friend with the king's son, it's hard for somebody to say, I represent the house of Saul and that's bad, because everybody inside the house of Saul is okay with you. So it takes away the opposition. It's like winning the popular vote and the electoral college. I don't know why that came to me, but just I spoke last week, 2 weeks ago, last week in Cincinnati, and I started off by saying that I felt bad for them because this was the only, it was a Jewish Federation group. It was the only crowd in the entire state that wasn't being spoken to by a presidential candidate, which they told me was really true. They said they don't answer their phones. Yeah. They get 30, 40 robocalls a day from, you know, the two campaigns. It's just wild. In California, we're out of it. We don't have storms. We don't have a presidential race, you know. Yes. As long as the ground stays level, we're, yes. But just remember this the next time somebody says to you, how could you live in Los Angeles? They have earthquakes. Okay? I just want to say, no place on earth is without its possibilities of disaster. Thank God. Okay. Jonathan took off his cloak and tunic he was wearing and gave them to David, together with his sword, bow, and belt. Now, someone actually wrote a whole article about clothing in the story of David, and which is not surprising because people have written articles about everything on earth. And what one of the things is that this is reminiscent of when Saul puts his garments on David. Remember when he's going to fight Goliath and David says, I can't wear these, they don't suit me. But he doesn't say that to Jonathan, because Jonathan is the heir to the throne, and presumably, I don't know, maybe he's built more like David, although they're not kids anymore. But he doesn't only put his clothes on him, he gives him his sword, bow, and belt, which is a clear transfer of power. It's everything, right? So all of a sudden, David has, without explicitly doing anything to undermine Saul, he's completely undermined Saul's house, because it's as if he's Saul's symbolic son. David went out with the troops, and he was successful in every mission on which Saul sent him, and Saul put him in command of all the soldiers. This pleased all the troops and Saul's courtiers as well. Whether it pleased Saul, we do not know, because he presumably put him out there but didn't anticipate the degree of success that David would have. And it seems as though Saul's a little slow in catching up to how either, depending on which side you want to be on, either how blessed David is or how Machiavellian David is, or both, actually, because he goes from success to success to success. When the troops came home and David returned from killing the Philistine, which is kind of, it's just a funny, you know, what'd you do today, honey? Oh, I was out killing Philistines. that's what it sounds like. David returned home, you know, he puts his feet up, has a drink, long day of killing Philistines. The women of all the towns of Israel came out singing and dancing to meet King Saul with timbrels, shouting, and sistrums, whatever those are. I don't know. How does altar translate that? What? Yeah, well, 1 second. How does he translate sistrums? Lute. Okay. And the Jerusalem Bible also lute. So sistrums are probably a kind of lute. Who knows? But I love that when they say sistrums, and then notice there's a little B at the bottom. It says meaning of Hebrew uncertain, as though everybody knows what a sistrum is, of course, but the Hebrew is uncertain. as far as I'm concerned, the English is at least as uncertain as the Hebrew. It does give you a picture, though, of what used to happen in the ancient world, that the women would wait for the men to return, and then they would go out into the streets and play music upon their return from war, which is kind of a, you know, it's just, women sang as they danced, and they chanted, Saul has slain his thousands, David his tens of thousands. Now, all of a sudden, there's no more denying it. Saul's in trouble. He's really in trouble, because obviously, the most important qualification for a king in ancient times was he had to be able to defeat the enemies. And the guy who can defeat more enemies is going to be more kingish. Saul was much distressed and greatly vexed about the matter, for he said to David, they've given tens of thousands to me, they've given thousands, all that he lacks is the kingship, which is an exact, clear-eyed evaluation of precisely what's going on. That's all that he lacks. And now he's in trouble, Saul. And from here, it's a sort of continual decline. And what is interesting to trace, and here it depends which historian you read. Modern historians tend to believe that every step in the decline of Saul was plotted in some ways by David, and they see all of David's maneuvers as a sort of systematic undermining of Saul. Medieval and ancient historians see more, and traditional historians, I should say, in the modern world, see more that this is God favoring Saul, David rejecting Saul, and Saul's gradual decline is in itself evidence that he wasn't ready for the kingship, and that makes some sense. I mean, because I don't want to get into modern politics, but let me just use an example, okay? You can say, well, the president wanted to do all this stuff but was blocked by the opposition Congress and it's their fault. Or you can say, the right president can get stuff done even with an opposition Congress. So you can say, Saul failed and it's his fault. Or you can say, if Saul had been an effective enough king, David would not have been able to undermine him. Right? You can see it either way, or both ways, or some combination thereof. But Saul has lost the momentum, to keep the same, and David has it. So from that day on, and here's really the, Saul kept, it really says an eye on David, but they sort of give an interpretation. Again, how does Alter put it? Does he say a jealous eye, right? They say jealous eye too, because that's the clear implication. It's not just that he's watching him, but that he's watching him jealous. I just read a quote this morning from Iris Murdoch, the novelist. She said, jealousy lasts a lifetime, which is bad news for the young. I thought that was great. You won't outgrow this, my child. What's that? Suspicious eye. Okay, suspicious, jealous, the same. Right, thank you. But the same idea, right? In other words, he's worried about David, and he is right to be worried because ultimately the people will prefer David to Saul. It's reminiscent a little bit. I think it's like when the quarterback gets injured and the second string quarterback goes in and has a great game. So the first string quarterback is supposed to feel happy that they won, but he doesn't, right? Because that's human nature. You know, you want the team to do well and your substitute to do badly. So it's like when a rabbi gives a good sermon here, okay. That's why when you find people in your life and so on who are genuinely happy for you when you do well, it feels so good because that element is so powerful an element in human nature that even though you would think that Saul would be glad, because ultimately, of course, it's in his interest that the Philistines be killed and the Israelites thrive, still the ego is so strong. And yeah. Go ahead. Okay, so this is right. All right, I would say it's a big philosophical question. I'm going to get to through half the, at least half the chapter before I go on to it. But I would the key here is obviously that the mission, the overarching mission here is to conquer and rule the land of Israel, and that's sort of, in a way, that's like we have to get that out of the way before all the other things that Israel is supposed to do, like build a temple, like establish worship. First, you have to get the land, and then we can, you know, first you have to conquer it, then you can establish the government. In modern times, it's somewhat different, but we'll come back to that. A lot of this also is bound up with the question of David and why does David become the Messiah and what is it that his virtue and his faults are. But look at the next verse, because we need to dispatch Saul. The next day, an evil spirit of God gripped Saul, and he began to rave in the house while David was playing the lyre, as he did daily. Saul had a spear in his hand and threw the spear, thinking to pin David to the wall, but David eluded him twice. So now that's a very fast acceleration of his jealousy and his rage, and he tries to kill David. Twice, in fact. Why David hung around after the first spear-throwing incident is a question, which you can give multiple answers, one of which is that you can't run away from the king so easily, because he's still the king. Another is that this might have been a clumsy attempt and David didn't really feel much. I mean, if Saul was really raving, he might not have been that dangerous to David. And the third is maybe it happened once and David called in witnesses, it doesn't say, or servants, so that people would know that Saul was doing this, because, you know, he wants evidence that Saul is not in his right mind. That just serves his purposes, after all. Right? The crazier Saul is, the better David is. Again, if we're going to go to old movies like Betty Davis movies, it wasn't a Betty Davis movie, but if you've ever seen Gaslight, same thing, right? Where basically a husband tries to drive his wife crazy. I wonder what is that evil laugh over there? That's what I want to know. Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him and had turned away from Saul. Now, what is, again, unanswerable is when it says that God made Saul crazy, what does that mean? Does that really mean that God made Saul crazy? That God actually said, I think I'll throw this, or is that the only interpretive mechanism available in the ancient world when someone goes crazy? You can't say, I mean, since everything is from God, you can't say, oh, well, he's just unbalanced, so it has to be God who made him go crazy. But Saul sounds, if you read, as we will, the whole thing, as I've said before, like a manic depressive, right? He has sad moments, which is why David's there with the lyre, but he also has frantic and manic and with a little touch of paranoia thrown in. And remember also that this is, you're watching a personality that's been under tremendous, almost unprecedented pressure. He's the first king, and he's the first king who's supposed to dispatch the Philistines, and he has not done such a good job, and all of a sudden comes along this young, successful, charming person right into his house, and he invited him in, and now everybody loves him better. So that's a lot of pressure for Saul to be under. And if he was fragile to start off with, it's not surprising that he snaps. So Saul removed him from his presence, but he can't get rid of him. Now David's already become too powerful for him to remove him from his presence and send him home. So he appoints him chief of 1,000 to march at the head of the troops. Now this also is foreshadowing, because David gets rid of Uriah later on. We'll read this, but basically David sleeps with Bathsheba, she gets pregnant, so he has to, and he can't persuade her husband to sleep with her for various reasons, so he wants to kill her husband, basically. And he tells Joab, who's his general, go march against the city, and by the way, make sure that Uriah's at the front of the line, okay? But he has learned this tactic, so to speak, from Saul, who tries to do it to him, and puts him at the head of the troops. And the head of the troops, obviously, is the one who's going to die first. So Saul is clearly thinking, all I have to do is get David dead in battle, and everything will be fine. The problem is, of course, that David doesn't die in battle. I think that in some ways the most remarkable thing about David in his whole life is that he dies of old age in bed, which is just, you know, it's just incredible. David was successful in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he was successful, he dreaded him. So now it's getting worse. Vayagar mipanav is literally, he like shrunk from his face. Okay, he couldn't face David. That's how terrified he was of David. Probably because, after all, if David is, and you have to think about it, Saul's afraid of two things, probably. If David is successful and is going to be king, Saul's going to lose his kingship. And what do you do with kings who are deposed? You don't leave them around so that they can lead a revolt against you. So Saul's both afraid of losing his kingship and losing his life. And he can't seem to get rid of David. He's lost the ability to do it politically. No one will stand for it. And no matter what he does with him, the guy's not dying on the battlefield. So he's in bad shape. And just to reinforce, all Israel and Judah love David because he marched at their head. So in other words, exactly what Saul did to kill him endears him. And everything Saul's doing is backfiring on him. And you'll notice, by the way, still, that even under Saul, it's still referred to as Israel and Judah. We don't think of it this way, but remember that the two halves of the country were only united, this is my graphic here, were only united under David and Solomon. And then after Solomon, they split apart and were split apart basically forever. This is what happened, just to remind you for a second. So you have Israel is the north and Judah is the south. Yes, they have many of the same traditions, but some are different. And people from the north will always be different from people from the south. One of the many interpretations of Jesus's teachings is that he was from the north. So he had different Jewish traditions from some of the people in the south, which is why when he went to the temple, which is in the south, he saw practices that he wasn't used to from the north. Okay, one of them. Anyway, so the north and the south were always different. When the 10 tribes lived in the north, basically Judah and the tribes, the Levites and the Kohanim were in the south. They attended to the temple, but really it was the tribe of Judah that was the south. David makes his capital in Jerusalem, which is in the south, but very close to the north. It's a way of uniting both parts of the country. Under David, finally, the country's united. Under Solomon, it's united. Under Solomon's kids, it splits apart again, okay? In 722, which is about 300 years after Solomon, maybe a little less, the northern part of the kingdom is destroyed. That's when the 10 tribes scatter, because they're all the ones living in the north. So when people talk about the lost 10 tribes, it's because the north was conquered by the Assyrians, who came from the north and conquered the north. They tried to conquer the south, but didn't succeed. The south lived about another 150 years. That is, Judah lived another 150 years. And then it was conquered by the Babylonians, who were the successor empire to the Assyrians. So the Assyrians came and destroyed the north, and then the Babylonians came and destroyed the south. Okay? The northern tribes, the 10 northern tribes that scattered, many of them probably went south, because they may have had a breach, but they were still closer than anyone else. And the rest just scattered to wherever they scattered to. The 10 lost tribes are really lost. Nobody knows where they went, but they probably, some of them became Assyrians or whatever. Some of them may have gone to northern Africa and spread some traditions there, because we're always finding, seven people in some village in North Africa who wear kippot or something like that. So when it says all Israel and Judah love David, it's an indication, I just want to say it's an indication that David is going to be able to unite all of Israel, which has not yet happened. Okay, so yeah, go ahead.
What? So why did this second division after Joshua entered the land, there was still one people?
It's a good question. It probably because Judah was the largest, strongest tribe, so people found their own niches in the north, because Judah basically took over the south. That's my guess. But I don't know why originally. I'll double check, yeah.
Why do you think Jonathan gives up his...
Okay, so... So let's, let me see if it's worth, we'll come back to Jonathan in a minute. Let me just finish with at least Saul's machinations to try to make David, to tame David. So he can't kill him. So Saul says to David, here's my older daughter Merav. I'll give her to you in marriage. In return, you be my warrior and fight the battles of the Lord. Saul thought, let not my hand strike him, let the hand of the Philistines strike him. In other words, I will continue to act towards him as a mentor, and I'll be his father-in-law, and no one will suspect that I'm going to get him killed. and then let me get him killed, right? So this is, and remember, you know, for those of us who have like exalted images of all of our forefathers, and for, this is the King of Israel talking, okay? This isn't some Schmendrick who has no status in, this is the King of Israel who's scheming and using his daughter in order to get the future King of Israel killed before he gets to the throne. So things don't change. Seriously, I mean, the whole business about the tradition of lionizing and making superhuman the people of the Bible depends on a lack of information. David replied to Saul, "Who am I? What is my life?" Which is, you know, basically a self-deprecating comment. "My father's family in Israel, that I should become your majesty's son-in-law." In other words, I'm not worthy. Now, why is David not worthy? Maybe because he knows what Saul is doing. He's not deceived. Saul's tried to kill him twice. He doesn't think all of a sudden, he tried to kill me, but now what he really wants is to be my father-in-law. But at the time that Merav, daughter of Saul, should have been given to David, she was given in marriage to Adriel the Meholathite. Now, why did that happen? Because David was dithering, because she had her own will, we don't exactly know, because Saul saw that it wasn't going to work, but there's an alternative up his sleeve. Now, Michal, daughter of Saul, had fallen in love with David, just like everybody else, apparently. And when this was reported to Saul, he was pleased. Saul thought, "I'll give her to him." This is what, by the way, reinforces the notion that Merav didn't want him, because he was pleased that Michal did, so he doesn't have to force her on him, which makes the only clear-eyed person in this entire story Merav, who we know nothing about, right? But she at least knows this is not the guy for me. Saul thought, "I will give her to him, and she can serve as a snare for him so the Philistines may kill him." Again, this is a little bit of hearkening back to what story? Where does a woman serve as a snare so Philistines can kill someone? Samson, remember? Delilah serves as a snare so that the Philistines can kill Samson. Remember, she hires a barber who cuts off his hair. Delilah does not cut off Samson's hair, by the way. She hires a barber. So, as I always say when I teach people, that's a good bar bet. Bet somebody in a bar next time that Delilah doesn't cut Samson's hair. You'll win a drink. So,
only on the Upper West Side,
that's right. Otherwise, people will say, "Who's that? Who's Delilah? Who's Samson?" So Saul said to David, "You can become my son-in-law even now through the second one." And Saul instructed his courtiers to say to David privately, "The king is fond of you, and all his courtiers like you, so why not become the king's son-in-law?" In other words, he's putting out a disinformation campaign. That's what it is, right? It's saying, "No, really, the king likes you." Okay, he was upset. He tried to kill you, but he didn't really mean it. And now that he sees what an effective warrior you are, so on, he wants to give you his daughter. When the king's courtiers repeated these words to David, David replied, "Do you think that becoming the son-in-law of the king is a small matter when I'm a poor man of no consequence?" Saul's courtiers reported to him, "This is what David answered." And Saul said, "Say this to David, 'The king desires no other bride price than the foreskins of 100 Philistines as vengeance on the king's enemies.' Saul intended to bring David's death at the hands of the Philistines." So Saul does something very clever, which is David having said, "I'm not worthy of this," Saul then puts out the word, "I told David he could become my son-in-law if he kills 100 Philistines." If David doesn't do it now, it's not that he's shrinking back because he's modest, because he doesn't want to be the king's son-in-law. It's that he's a coward, that he won't become the king's son-in-law by killing 100 Philistines. So now he almost has to do it, because otherwise no one will say it's that he thinks he's not worthy of becoming the king's son-in-law. They'll all say he's afraid of the Philistines. So it was actually a fairly clever maneuver on the part of Saul. Of course, like everything else, it backfires because David is going to go out and kill 100 Philistines. When his courtiers told this to David, David was pleased with the idea of becoming the son-in-law. Now, he wasn't before. Why is he pleased now? Because he has no choice. And when you have no choice, it is best to be pleased, right? David knows this already. if you're going to do it, don't do it reluctantly or with 100 caveats. Just do it already. So David went out with his men and killed 200 Philistines. Presumably, he circumcised them after their death. one hopes, because you're allowed to have sympathy for dead Philistines, too. And David brought their foreskins, and they were counted out for the king. Now, can you imagine that scene? Oh, my Lord. Don't say that the Bible isn't full of vivid imagery. That he might become the king's son-in-law, Saul then gave him his daughter Michal in marriage. When Saul realized the Lord was with David and Michal, the daughter of Saul, loved him, Saul grew still more afraid of David, because now it's not that Michal is going to undermine David on Saul's behalf, because she actually loves him. And Saul was David's enemy ever after. Now, that's an important line, because at several points, Saul's going to say, I really love you. But it says here clearly that we need to know that you shouldn't take Saul's protestations of love too seriously. They will never last, okay? The Philistine chiefs marched out to battle, and every time they marched out, David was more successful than all the other officers of Saul. His reputation soared. Okay, so let's stop there. Chapter 18, take questions and comments and so on. Yeah. Oh, and then I'll come back, Angela, to the question of why Jonathan did it. I'm not sure what the question is.
Well, you said that he was pleased. But why wouldn't he be pleased when he's a famous warrior and in order for him now to honorably get married? In his mind,
well, I suppose that's true, although it's clear that he's walking into an intended trap. It's true, but I mean, there has to be some trepidation, I would think. Maybe not. It's possible that he was genuinely pleased. But I'm not convinced. I don't know. Maybe. And about why Jonathan gives this up. So you can only speculate. But here would be my guess. And this is completely without any foundation other than my guess. First of all, you got to figure that Saul's not such an easy father. Right? It doesn't sound like this is somebody whose son you would wish to be. He's emotionally unstable. And he's in a position that does not help him. And you have the experience of growing up in the house of somebody whose job has destroyed them. So you might not aspire to it. And along comes this guy who really wants it and seems to be good at it. And you have basically two choices. You can fight him or love him. So maybe Jonathan just decides that this is better for him and better for... And also later we see that Jonathan is very noble. His troops love him. So it might also be that he just nobly thought, this guy's really better at this than I am. And he should be the king and I shouldn't be the king. That's also conceivable. And remember, there hasn't yet been, even though the hereditary principle exists in most of the world, it hasn't been established in the kingship in Israel because Saul's the first king. So people might assume that Jonathan's going to be the king, but doesn't have to be. Yeah.
When I read this, for some reason the story of Jacob popped into my head. Jacob seems to be the template of this in my mind.
Jacob and Joseph. Joseph too. Because the brothers, he's the younger brother who succeeds and becomes the king. So there's both.
So my next question to you is, I then found my way to Samuel. There's no reference to the five books of Moses.
No.
There's no reference to the patriarchs.
Nope.
No reference to the law, the ethics. It's as though it doesn't exist. Oh, what Samuel had in mind or didn't have in mind by ignoring the entire scripture.
Well, it's not Samuel. Samuel's not the author of the book. It's just named for him.
Oh.
What did the author of the book have in mind? I mean, it could be anything from, it just didn't come up. There was just no reason to mention them in the course of telling the story.
What?
It depends when that injunction was written. I mean, if you're a modern biblical scholar, it was written in the book of Deuteronomy, and this is the Deuteronomic historian. It's the same person who wrote that who wrote this, so he's working at the same time. But even if you read it every year, that doesn't mean that you have to mention them all the time. They're mentioned in scattered places throughout the rest of Tanakh, but not that often. Not that often. You didn't need it to tell the story of David necessarily. In fact, the other possibility which just occurs to me is you might want, since you're trying to establish the house of David forever, maybe you don't want that as the same reason you don't mention Moses in the Haggadah, you don't want that as the competition. You want people to refer to David, not to refer to Abraham, because it's not the house of Abraham that's going to be established forever. It's the house of David. I don't know. Yeah. Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah, that's a good point.
I'm not quite sure what to make of it.
Right. There they circumcise them to disable, they circumcise themselves once they're disabled, they kill them. Right. Here they kill them presumably first and then circumcise them. I don't know if there's an intended parallel or not. That I don't know. Yeah. It depends for whom. Right. Yeah.
Why does Saul say go bring me 200 horsemen? Doesn't it say go kill them?
Right. I think it's a euphemism. I just think it's a euphemism. I think it's just a euphemism. It's like saying bring me their heads. You know? I really think that it's a way of saying go kill 100 Philistines. How do I put this nicely? You, Saul. I think that's why. I think that's why. That, yeah.
Just an appendix to your comment about the homosexuality.
Yeah.
I was reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's book about human rights and the story of these men, Seward.
Right. Yep. In fact, in that book, I don't remember who it is who dies first. Like Seward lies on Chase's bed as he's dying, or vice versa. He actually climbs in. Who was it? Oh, you'll see when you get there. I didn't, because I don't know who died. I can't remember. I read it a while ago, but one of them dies. Actually, in the end, by the way, they all die. I hate to tell you that, but the point is that he's, I don't remember, it could even have been Lincoln, who climbs into bed with him as he's dying. Which, you know, is, I mean, that there was an intimacy and a familiarity that was, men have lost. Not women, but men have lost. And it's...
It is all the speculation about Lincoln
and his law great, partner. His law partner. Because they lived in the same little, yeah.
Lawyers on both sides would travel the circuit,
right.
And they sleep in the same bed.
Yeah. So it was a difference. Well, one of the things is that intimacy is created by lack of space, too. You know? I mean, the idea that everybody has their own room, and for most of human history, it's not just that everybody has their own room, it's that everybody had one room. You know? That, I mean, of course kids watched their parents have sex, because there was nowhere else to go. Where were you going to go? So it's a very different, and the idea of, like, you know, that your kid shouldn't sleep in your bed, well, for most of history, that's what people did. So, anyway. Yeah?
So, is it significant that the last line of the second half of 29, and Saul was David's enemy ever after, as opposed to David was Saul's enemy?
Well, so, oh, I'm glad you said that, because here's something that's that you read again and again and again, and it's so interesting to think about this. It's almost like, do you know the Gestalt pictures where you see a cup, but then if you close your eyes and you look again, you see two faces, and then you close your eyes again and you see a cup, and it's the same picture, but you see them completely differently, and you can't see them both at the same time. That's the key to it, is when you see the cup, you can't see the faces. When you see the, it's a very bizarre and interesting thing. The way that modern, not all modern, but many modern historians read this is written by somebody who's trying to make David look good and still, but can't avoid the facts of the story. Because everyone knows the facts of the story, but they want to tell it in a way that makes David not look good, not look bad. So one way of reading this is, he can say Saul was David's enemy and not say David was Saul's enemy, because that's not a fact. Everybody knows what happened, right? And throughout the whole story, he's trying to make it as though David didn't intend for Saul to meet this terrible end, and for all of David's enemies to meet this terrible end, because they all do. But they do, and he's trying to tell it in a way that exonerates David. The other way to read this, and you can read it this way with equal plausibility, it's just the face or the cup, is David really is gifted. He really is a successful warrior. Saul really is a paranoid. Saul really is David's enemy. He starts throwing spears at him when he's just there playing the lyre. And eventually it was inevitable that David was going to usurp him. And he doesn't do it because he's a bad guy, and he doesn't do it because he's power hungry. He does it because clearly he's on the upward trajectory and he's the one who's supposed to lead Israel, and Saul's not. So you can think of it as, let's say there's a family that has two kids and they have a business, and one of the kids is really gifted in business. And it's clear from the beginning that he's the one who should be running the business, and especially if it's the younger son. So you can say he systematically undermined his older brother, which could be true. Or you could say it's just clear. It was always clear that the older brother is just, he didn't run the business well, and the younger brother could. So it's not, you know, at this distance, you have to decide, and you'll decide over the course of reading it, which reading makes more sense to you. But. Yeah, right, exactly. Right, that's exactly. You have to wait until I finish the book. Yes?
Why does it have to be so unclear when it seems like from the Bible point of view, is that what they mean?
Because the question is, do you know what, in literature there's something called an unreliable narrator. The most famous example of this is Great Gatsby, if you read The Great Gatsby. But in some ways, the best example is a book by Ford Madox Ford called The Good Soldier. And it begins with a great, it says, "This is the saddest story I ever heard." It's a great book. And the point of an unreliable narrator is that as you read, you realize that what they're saying and what's happening are different. And you read it through the narrator. Even though the narrator's saying this, if the author is skillful enough, you realize that. So here, the narrator's not trying to be unreliable, but it is still possible that he's presenting things in a way that you can read through the cracks. It's possible. So yeah, you can say, no, everything he says is exactly right, and David is completely good-hearted, and these bad things just keep happening to his enemies because other people love David and support him, and the Bathsheba Uriah thing is just an anomaly. He doesn't normally, you know, sleep with married women and kill their husbands. Just this once. But it's possible not. It's possible to see it as, you know, as an attempt to put the best face on what is a startling string of victories for David. So, Don.
I'm curious.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a big question. You could come away with anything from, the modern lesson is that flawed human beings still accomplish great things. right? That's the lesson that you're going to get from a rabbi today. The traditional lesson is that God, through David, establishes his kingdom forever, and that ultimately the Messiah will arise from the house of David because he's the one chosen by God. That's the traditional lesson. What's that? Yeah, that's the cup, exactly. That's the cup. That's the Yiddish cup. But along the way, there are all sorts of lessons in human nature, and there are also lessons, I think, in the dynamics of families and the dangers of ambition, as well as the goodness of some ambition, and the necessity of, especially when you get to the Amnon Tamar Avshalom story, the necessity of boundaries and what happens in families. Anyway, but we'll get to that. Yeah.
Interesting gloss on this from Alexander's last words as he was dying. It's kind of best to give your empire to the strongest.
Yeah, exactly. To the strongest. But his empire then got divided into three, because no one was Alexander. But that's exactly what happened to Solomon. Alexander dies, and all of a sudden his empire gets cracked up into three, and it never gets united again. And the same thing happens with Solomon. Solomon dies, and the empire gets split into two, and is never to be united again. Not until hundreds and hundreds of years later, in the Second Temple. But one of the interesting ways of looking at the story of David is looking at it through other ancient conquerors, because it's the same world that the world that David lives in is a lot closer to the world of Alexander than it is to the world of modern Jews. A lot closer. Yeah.
Why was David self-deprecating when Saul asked him to be his son-in-law and he said, "I am not worthy, I'm just a poor guy"?
My guess is, so one way of seeing it is because he didn't think he was worthy. Maybe he didn't think he was worthy to be the king. Right, exactly. The other way is to believe that is the appropriate response, and that any other response would have been seen as arrogant. Like, yeah, sure, love to marry this king's daughter. So that's also possible. I mean, it could have been this sort of unctuous, "I'm not worthy," like a Dickens Uriah Heep. I'm not worthy, when everyone knows that he really thinks that he's very worthy. I don't know. There's no one. My guess is that was the appropriate and expected response. And it doesn't reflect badly on David that he said it. It's exactly what he should have said and what ought to have been said, and any other response would have been wrong. So that's what you say when the king says, "Do you want to marry my daughter?" Yes, presumably Saul would give the kingship to Jonathan, although actually I think what Saul wants is to just stay king for a while, right? And then, let the future take care of itself. And Jonathan is a little bit like Pippin, if you ever saw that show, It's a great, great musical. He doesn't want to be king. He's the son of the king, and he doesn't want to go, do all the things that kings are supposed to do. Maybe he thinks, first of all, maybe he thinks that Jonathan will be king, but Saul's a fairly young man. I assume that he thinks he should be king right now. He certainly doesn't want, right? Yeah. No? Yes. Last one.
Merab.
Yes.
Saul promises David Merab and then changes his mind.
Either changes his mind or Merab says no.
Mm-hmm. And maybe David is sitting there saying, "Well, he changed his mind once. What will prevent him from changing his mind a second time?" And so the question, "I'm not worthy," and all that, is David's way of finding out what standard will Saul set that he can meet, mm-hmm. so Saul cannot change his mind and withhold the cup.
Possible. It is possible. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the, we would have to probably know more about the etiquette of court. But remember also when we talk about court, you know, when you say kings, we have this image of a court, but this is like, you know, it's not like Saul had a palace. So the one thing that I would guess is that everyone knew everything that was going on. It was, there were servants all over the place, or warriors, all not servants, but warriors all over the place, and they didn't have, you know, as I said, there weren't separate rooms and there weren't big palaces, and so maybe what we're watching is a very delicate diplomatic dance in which everyone knows everything that's going on and everybody has to say certain things to get the result that they want. And David just turns out to be better at it than anybody else around him. So he gets to be the king. Yes, he does. He does seem to be that. And you have to imagine that he couldn't possibly have, as I said, he couldn't possibly have succeeded for so long if he wasn't such a good politician. So he does. It actually reminds me of the question that a past president asked me when I was interviewing for the synagogue. He said, I have only one question for you. And if you ask me privately, I'll tell you which president asked me this. I said, what? He said, are you good at politics? Which was kind of an interesting question for someone to ask. So.
Very smart question for the head of a huge synagogue.
To ask, yeah. So.
Are you?
I will actually, the answer is, if I die of old age in my bed, yes.